Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations. This is episode 4, part 2 on the Carnegie Mellon School series with focus on organizational routines. For more information on the series and this episode, please go to www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. If you haven't listened to part 1, please go and do so first, as this is going to pick up from where that left off. And now, back to the conversation.
The point I wanted to make, going back to your earlier comment, Demetrius, about how they seem to have a supra-individual level in their theory, I'm not so sure about this. At least that's not the impression that I got from the reading. For me, the way they talk about organizations is that organizations are just a collective of individuals. Where you see that most prominently is when they talk about coalitions and how goals and organizations form, because they essentially say, well, organizations don't have a goal, but it's individual members that have different goals. And then in order to agree on certain goals for the organization, they form coalitions and bargain and they do stuff like that. So I didn't necessarily see the super individual level.
No, I get that. They never say, I think explicitly, that organization is a super cognition. Neither do they say that there is some kind of a panpsychism where all members of the organization partake in something common beyond their work, I suppose. But it's just here and there, the way they speak about what organization does. Like, for instance, in the book Organizations on page 145, they say that performance programs are part of the control system of the organization, and organizations attempt to control employees by specifying standard operating procedures. Or then on page 170 in the same book, they talk about organizations having a repertory of programs that is adaptive in short run and in long run, and that is a difference between problem solving and learning. So organizations are being referred to in a sense that they are somehow self-sufficient. It's not that they're saying that goals of certain managerial parties, for instance, is to control through standard operating procedures, or that learning occurs at local level and then is contested throughout the organizational structure until it reaches some kind of hegemony. But it's all about organizations this and organizations that. Maybe it's an implicit assumption on their part, and maybe Jim March can help us understand what's happening there. But that is why I said about the super individual thing. And their statements about learning seem to support that. That it's not thinking of learning as a contested process of multiple entities. That would be individuals or local clusters of individuals, but it's this one thing.
It's so interesting that you got this impression, Demetrius, because I felt the entire time they were actually talking about managers designing performance programs and deciding top down who's doing which task. And so I had this feeling that they have a very top down managerial work. Also, when they talk about how performance programs control employees and stuff like that. But I know it's just my impression that I got, because nowhere in the text they talk about managers.
That is very interesting. I mean, you have spent way more time studying this than I have, and presumably you understand what you're talking about, which is more than I can say for myself. But because my work is in things like organizational memory and learning, maybe that's why I picked up on this more sensitively than you seem to have.
Dimitri, when you talk about learning as contested,
yes,
you know, that got my attention, because I agree with you. And it does seem that March and Simon, and then in the second book, they talk about, it comes across to me as if, well, they're just learning these things. And what I've seen in my research in organizations and my experience in organizations is that is far from the truth, that yes, a lot of the learning is very highly contested, and people will draw widely different lessons or ideas about what's to be learned from certain situations. And it's not easy to impose externally uniformity of thought or, you know, understanding about that. So I thought that was a great observation.
Yeah, I don't know how much we can challenge these two works on that, though, because when we talk about learning, we say things like contestation are in opposition to these more homogeneous unitary models. But as Katerina said in the end of part one, when they were putting these ideas forward, they were dealing with the omniscient view of super rational, all-knowing, you know, person, yes, in the organization. I think it's a good way to carry this forward into where we are now and where we're going possibly in the future. But of course, with hindsight, It seems a bit overly simplistic, I suppose.
But it's interesting because, I mean, when they talk about goals, they have a lot of power plays and actually people arguing about the goals and bargaining and not agreeing on the goals and all that stuff. So it's interesting that they don't have that same when they talk about learning. I just noticed that's actually a good point that you pick up, Demetrius.
Thank you.
I think regarding to that, my issue is very similar, but it's not only about the contestation, the politics, it's also because, as Catherine, I think, was saying in the first part, is that they never really show how all these things happen. So it's not only that they never show that things are not automatic, but they assume that learn ought to take place, but they never say how is it learning, you know, because it seems very simple, you know. A certain situation comes up and the organization adapts to that. And if it adapts, it learns and it's all done. And people that study learning from mistakes and all those kind of things know that it's not that simple to make organizations change the way they do things and assume new practices. So, well, limitations.
Well, and particularly because there's a lot of research that shows that some organizations learn better than others and process the information better as sort of collectively. I know that's not trying to make the organizations super individual, but this idea that people in the organizations can learn better. And there are White and John Carroll talk about those kinds of things, about how people in organizations learn. I'm not really trying to criticize March and Simon so much as saying we've learned more since then. So there's more complexity. Yes. And, you know, maybe they just weren't thinking about that at the time. As Katerina was saying, they were looking at it from and bargaining and power plays in the context of goals. But maybe they didn't take it to that other level. Or I can't really say they didn't realize it, but just didn't pursue it in those other aspects of organizational behavior.
I like this idea because it hits at the point that, you know, not all organizations are the same. If you want, some organizations are more organizations than others. And you read the books, it seems that, you know, they're all function in the same way. And as you said, Ralph, very well, it isn't. They have some process that enable some things and that others are not able to do.
In addition to that, they also have this underlying assumption that organizations want to operate or that people in organizations make rational decisions. I mean, relative to their frame of reference, so that's their bounded rationality, but they still assume individuals act rationally and they always make the best choice that they can choose. But Jim March later on writes about the garbage can model, which is saying the exact opposite. That is that people don't always act rationally, and actually in organizations resemble more kind of chaotic anarchy rather than this organized system. So it's actually interesting that he then takes the exact opposite view later on.
I have a question, I think, for you, Katerina, because I want to go back to the thing that you're discussing with Dimitri about the managers and top-down view or not. The thing that, for me, I also had the impression that Dimitri's had when I was reading all that, it seemed to me that there are no managers in the story. Once you set up the routines and all the performance programs, the standards and all the plans in place, the managers can go home because the structures is so that things should just progress in a way. Nobody needs to tweak things, control things, coordinate anymore. So I was wondering, in the bigger picture, what is the relation between managers and routines? You know, are there works that talk about that? They usually have these idea that managers are the ones setting up the routines? How does this thing play?
I think, yeah, the traditional literature assumes that managers design the routines. Actually, I have a difficulty pinpointing where exactly. Maybe it's more in Nelson and Winter. I'm not so sure. But I mean, definitely also if you look at these two books that we read now, essentially it's a theory of decision making. And when you think about, so who's making decisions, usually you come to managers. They make decisions. And I think the impression that if you have performance programs in place and then everything runs smoothly, that's not what they assume, because they say, well, essentially organizations operate by facing problems and then making decisions. So you still need the managers to make decisions when, for example, the performance programs don't work anymore because the environment is changing or something like this. I wouldn't see that they don't have any managers in their theory, but it's true they don't talk about managers.
It's very interesting that you just mentioned about the external environment, because I don't think that's how it is with contemporary theory of routines, but this one is hedged against a hope that things don't change. So the way the routines are here are defined is that they are patternized responses to certain situations, essentially. So what happens when situations change? Then shouldn't be that routines fail or at least don't perform as well. And the mention of managers steering, adjusting, sort of patching up routines is a very good way to bring them back into the picture.
I think they do acknowledge that environments can change, because at somewhere in their book they talk about how the more the environment is stable or certain situations are repetitive, the more you will routinize the programs, and the more the environment is dynamic, the more you will have non-programmed activities, non-routine.
Oh yeah, I didn't mean to suggest that they don't think that environments change. It's just the hedging of the definition against a stable environment, I think, is what may give the impression that it can be automated through routines entirely.
It's funny because I don't see it that way. You know, this whole insistence that they have on learning and adaptation and the stimulus and responding to the stimulus, and the fact that routines are not only the things that are ought to take place, but also how you're going to change them, just seems to me that it's perfectly to deal with the environment, all the things that you can hit an organization with. You have to have a structure in place to respond. I think it fits in a way, I think, the theory.
But to be honest, before reading the readings, I had this idea, this everyday idea of routines, what routines are. So this idea of regularity and repetition. And that's what I carried with me while I was facing the readings. And the thing is that it did strike me that the environment was important and that there was this idea of a stable environment. And that could fit in my mindset of something that repeats itself, a routine. But maybe then, when I was going towards the end of the readings, my question was, is routine actually the right word? Because we have discussed that it came out afterwards. Mm-hmm. So I had this constant doubt as if, is routine really, really the right word that we're using? Why did they choose routine? Because someone else chose it afterwards. So let's say that internally I was battled between what I was reading and what I was learning and what I already had in terms of everyday knowledge.
Good point.
How would you have labeled what they were describing? I mean, what word would you use?
I don't know. I would use a lot of words, because sometimes we're talking about structure. Sometimes we're talking about rules. Sometimes there's an idea of role. In my mind, it depended a lot on the level on which we were referring to. Maybe that is my main issue with this reading, that I had a struggle in understanding the clean-cut concept of routine. And I was confused by my everyday culture or baggage or linguistic associations.
I think the reason why they refer to it as routine and they continue to refer to it is this idea that there's a pattern of action or a program of action. So something recognizable, like a certain sequence of actions. And I know that this is maybe not the way that we use the word routine in our everyday life, because there we use it more to describe kind of mindless activities, automatic activities. That's true. So in the literature, the label routine has a different meaning. But essentially, I think what all scholars on routines, no matter what perspective they take, agree on is that routines are patterns of action. So there's action, there's a certain pattern. And then you can argue about whether it's pre-designed or whether it's enacted or, you know, stuff like that. That's the common denominator.
Right. Is it patterns of action or patterns of reaction, though?
That's a tricky one.
It's a good point, Demetrius, because I had the same feeling. The way they describe routines is, in general, organization behavior is very reactive. At some point, they also describe organizations as fire departments, essentially just going from one crisis to another and reacting to it.
Well, yeah, there is an external stimulus from the environment that we discussed so thoroughly, and that triggers a routine or a specific performance program. That's how it works, doesn't it?
Can I share a different question? So going back to what Miranda was saying, the multiple words we can use, I think the one that it's still hard for me to fully understand the picture is rules. Because I think in a way in the reading sometimes routine seems very close to rules. And I cannot really fully understand the connection. I can see that routines have rules. I cannot see how a routine can be a rule.
Well, it can be if it's a routine about other routines.
Okay.
For instance, on page 140 in organizations, they write, "Thus, we may distinguish substantive planning, developing new performance programs from procedural planning, developing programs for the problem-solving process itself.
Yes, I think they don't make a distinction between rules and performance programs. For them, rules are performance programs and vice versa.
I think here would be a good place for them to insert that rules are performance programs of the powerful
yes.
few.
You can send this suggestion for the third edition.
I think it's only in 2020 or so.
Well, there's not much to go, you know, 2016 is there.
That's true.
But I think going back to what you're saying about patterns of action or patterns of reaction, I also struggle with this because, you know, they have this all this typical insistence of early theory on stimulus and how you respond to stimulus and so on and so forth. But I think the fact is for them, stimulus are always happening. So that's the point. And they're not only external. Everything that happens inside that triggers something else, which is every day, every time, basically, can be a stimulus. In this way, action and reaction are almost the same thing, I think, for them.
Well, this, I think, and I'd love to hear what Katrina has to say, but internal stimuli do not come into play if you have a entity-like understanding of the organization. Does that make sense?
No.
If organization is kind of like one, then it doesn't bother itself.
Okay.
So that's why I think we may be stuck with external stimuli only. And as far as identifying what counts as a stimulus, do you think that this is almost a Newtonian model of organizational behavior, where if we knew all the factors that may occur, we would be able to resolve all the problems forever and ever?
I'm not sure about the later part, because I know I'm not the big history thought guy, it's you, but as for the earlier part, I think that they explicitly talk about how different departments interact with others and how what the production department needs to produce is linked to what the sales department needs to sell, what the purchasing needs to purchase. So you can see all these interdependencies across departments as stimulus as well, I think.
Yeah, that's true, but I think I tend to agree with Demetrius. I also got the impression that what I mean by stimulus is essentially what comes from the environment of the organization. I mean, it's true that once the sales department gets an order from the environment and they, of course, then trigger the production to produce something, you can see that as a stimulus, but it's essentially also pre-planned and pre-designed because there's a performance program that specifies if the sales department gets an order, then they have to notify the production plan to produce the product. Like what they're concerned about when they talk about definition of the situation, how you need to decide what is the stimulus and what's the appropriate performance program, these are the stimulus that come from outside and that the organization needs to deal with.
Yeah, because one sales order comes in, that's already a routine that is in place. Going through the organization, through to production and delivery, that's all one routine. One thing though, I feel perhaps we're insisting too much on routines here, which isn't entirely out of place given the topic of today. But routines only become established when the external stimulus is frequent enough. They don't say that everything that organization does is necessarily in one way or another informed by some routine. I think they say that if something happens in the environment often enough, then a routine will take root and become developed through basically learning to deal with the stimulus, right?
Yes, yes, I would agree. They also talk about non-programmed activities, etc. Yes.
No, I just wanted to ask something related to this. Well, it was written in the 50s, so I suppose I already have my answer. But all of these concepts of stimuli repeating itself in the environment and routines being developed as a consequence, it's particularly suitable for firms that have a certain history, a certain age. So I was wondering, in times in which it's much more common to have maybe a lot of small firms that go through their cycle quite quickly, some of these assumptions, some of these, I think, break down.
So are you questioning the value of routines for smaller, more dynamic organizations?
Like startups?
I'm questioning the idea of routines, a lot of activities that firms undertake at the beginning.
At the beginning of the book, I think they say in the introduction somewhere, they set out to develop a theory of formal organizations, of complex, multi-product, big firms. They say it explicitly. So I think they didn't, when they were developing the theory, they were not thinking about startups. However, I would say with the new development or the new understanding of routines, which was developed by Martha Feldman and Brian Pentland, which also talks about how routines contribute to change, I would say certainly routines also play a big role in startups. But it's true from when they wrote the book, it was more about big, large, established organizations.
I want to build on that just a bit. Just because I think one of the things I was hitting at the beginning is that I was very interested to understand how routines fit the overall functioning of organizations, and the theory and the books being so wide in scope made me understand that. And one of the things I understood is that they seem to have an economical value, because as we know, since rationality is limited and complexity requires different devices to be grasped, routines help in that. So routines are set up in a way that they can help to accomplish specific goals, to deal with a number of things, and so on and so forth. Is this something that still is discussed in the literature? Because I don't know it so much as Katharina does, but I feel that as we have opened the black box, you know, we don't look so much about the positive value of routines inside the organization, what they do, why are they set up in the first place? Or maybe just a misconception that I have.
The current literature is also very much concerned with what role routines play in organizations. I mean, it's true when the first Martha Feldman wrote her piece, it was more about understanding how routines contribute to organizational change. So that was a very particular way of looking at routines. But there now have been studies that look at how routines also contribute to organizational schematas, organizational identity and character, stuff like that.
But I think I was hitting at more the operational thing, you know, not so much the theory. So as routines as something that's important to set up in organizations because they enable organizations to don't have to deal with everything all the time. You have, I don't know, like a, or any kind of multinational corporation that has HRM practices, you know, if you want to talk about hiring, that they have to be sure that they are the same across all the different sites for not only normative purposes. So routines are a building block for that. Because this is very clear in the book.
Yeah, it's this idea that routines contribute to efficiency.
Yes.
I think that's still very much true. We don't deal with it as much in the literature because it has been said. That's my feeling.
Oh, okay. Okay. Does Ralph have anything to say about that on the practitioner side? Because I remember at the beginning you were hitting that, you know, as you read the book, you were thinking about the different organizations have been through.
Yes, I was listening to all of what you said, and I thought it was very interesting. So one thing at the when we were going down this path of routines that struck me was, in the many organizations I've studied and many I've participated in, there was no such thing as like really a routine or like a routine, you know, situation. So it strikes me as a very significant simplification for what really goes on, because no two, even you could say situations were similar, you know, you had these repeated, there was lots of variation within those similarities just because of the dynamic nature of the environment. So when you start talking about complex firms, rapid change, and an environment that's got many external stimuli that don't necessarily repeat predictably, I argue that the whole notion of a performance program or routine is a, I'm not saying it's wrong, I'm just saying it's a significant simplification, because that kind of bargaining and, you know, processing reality and understanding which routine to use and is this the right situation or does it have to be adapted, that's constantly going on in an organization. That was one thing that struck me. The other thing that struck me was perhaps an extension or just a digression from what you were talking about was, I thought it was really interesting they were talking about the idea that one of the reasons for having routines in an organization were that make it so the organization didn't have to predict the future, you know, manage uncertainty. So I was thinking, that's one thing that's going to get you in big trouble, though, is if you say, oh, yeah, I'm going to try to imagine this world as a predictable place and I won't have to forecast uncertainty. So maybe that was more true back in the 50s than it is now. But I think now we see a lot of examples of firms that they're not trying to manage complexity or not necessarily manage, but at least understand what the environmental influences are and how to respond dynamically, they're in trouble. You know, that significantly affects their efficiency and performance.
I must say that I did not expect you to take up this position coming from the military.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I will tell you, lots of uncertainty in the military and lots of uncertainty in shipyards and overhaul procedures, and it's always something new. And one of the key issues we always had to say was, okay, well, is this a routine where we know how to function? Or do we have to modify it some? You know, how is that done? Is it done with people at the local level? What levels Do you have to get permission to deviate from? I mean, that's a constant source of uncertainty and complexity in military organizations.
Right, but would the examples that you provided fall into the domain of routines? Because the routines need to be at least by way of these two readings. They arise through repeated same homogeneous stimulus affecting the organization. So basically the same thing happening over and over again.
Yeah, and the answer is no. Lots of what you see, and that's my point of disagreement, is that there's not very much that's actually repeatable consistently over and over again, that there's maybe at the micro level. But in many cases, there's a general similarity in some of the things, but there are always key and important differences. So probably does not fall in that category. But that's my point, is that very little does, not only in the military environment, but also in the modern economy.
I think this is a perfect, perfect example of what you're describing, is the paradox of the never and ever changing world. It's this idea that if you go really close to something, you see that it's all different, there's lots of variations, it's never the same situation. And if you zoom out of it and you look at it from very far away, you see, oh, it's all the same, it all looks similar. And both is routine. And that's the fascinating thing about routines, is if you zoom out, it all looks the same. And if you zoom in, it's all different. I think, Ralph, you're going to love the current routines literature, because they're trying to get at exactly what you're describing.
I just want to add that the texts, they have something interesting to say about that in light of the current literature. I think Paul Carlyle recently wrote a piece about process and process theorizing, saying that, you know, of course, we have to look at, you know, how things happen, but you should not forget that, you know, some things are more stable than others. Some things exactly are changing all the time, every day. He gives the example of the river. Of course, the river is always changing, but if you go there after 1 year, maybe the river is still there. So the river in itself is still there, but, you know, the water might have changed. So there is like a layering process in that. And they talk about that, I think, in the behavior theory on page 122. And they talk about exactly how different procedures apply to different almost rhythms and different levels of change. There are some contemporary ideas on that already in the book.
Okay, so if we're going to go down the Heraclitean route of you can't step to the same river twice, what is...
I didn't want to go there. I quoted Carlyle. Well, I didn't quote the philosopher.
Paul arguably is not far off.
Too late.
Then what use can we make of this concept altogether? Why do we need routines? Why can't we just do away with patterns of action? Why do we need all this baggage, basically?
Well, I'm not saying I know the answer, but I think it, based on what the authors wrote, it has to do with simplifying the complexity. They write about that and say that's one of the reasons why organizations need routines, because at a certain level of zooming, you have to manage that complexity. And so it gives people a template. And I just made the case that you just have to realize the template will never fit exactly, and there's adjustments you have to do. But I do think there's something to be said for it fits with our idea of bounded rationality. It helps the boundedly rational actors in the organization, you know, manage these kind of repeating stimuli and how to respond, or not having to think of everything for the first time on the spot. That's what I would say.
Well, it binds them further, doesn't it, though?
Yes.
They're already bounded, these poor creatures, and you're imposing routines. On page 140, says beautifully in the organizations that once you come up with a solution to a recurring stimulus, then such activity is distinguished by the fact that it can be dispensed with once the performance program has been learned. So once you have something that sort of works, you can stop trying to come up with a better solution. And I know that they're emphasizing that in organizations it's not the optimal solutions, but the good enough, which is the bounded rationality, of course. But this seems to be a way to, at least by way of this definition, to paralyze the knowledge aspects of the organization. So the more routines you have, the less you think and the more you automate, and you go down this path until everything is just working, you know, thoughtlessly.
Well, I don't really agree with that, because I think the important thing here is that structure is enabling. So having a place to start, having a map is a place to start. And I think when they discuss about decision-making, they always insist that, you know, it always starts with a search processes, and you start the search process around your previous solutions, around what you already know, and you have to have some limitations to where to proceed. You know, the whole point of rationality is bounded because there are limits. You cannot consider everything at once. So I think it's not necessarily I see what you're trying to say. No, it can almost becomes like this iron cage, you know, that, you know, everything becomes so automatic that there's no breathing space anymore. But I think we can also see that in a way that you see the routines as, you know, orientation in a complex situation.
I don't think it's an iron cage as much as it's a Plato's cave, where routines can, at least following the line of argument here, that they can very much become the shadows that are shadows of something else.
I think you have a good point, Dimitri. I think you've gone down a little further down the path that I was originally willing to, but I'm right there with you. Pedro, I agree with you that it helps you. Structure is enabling, which I think is a great line. I wrote that down. So that part's good. But Dimitri, I think the other side of that coin is, yeah, but they can channel thought, they can channel creativity, they actually restrict people. And so the key challenge, I think that's what I was talking about, that where I was trying to get at when I was saying that at a certain level, depends, like Katarina said, what level you want to look at, that there's no such thing as a repeating, you know, pattern of behavior or stimuli. Dimitri, you're right, that you can have organizations that basically just know one way to respond. And when those routines don't respond any well, there's actually a tendency for people to distort the data and think things are working when they're not. So I thought that was a great point to say there's limitations and risks in routines as well.
Building on that, I'd still like to understand more about why we need routines beyond the enabling factors and the sort of stimulus responding factors.
I think the other aspect that you might want to take into account, and that was really something that when I did my fieldwork for my PhD at the startup company, actually, what I found surprising was that the employees were actually asking for routines and for rules of how to do things. They were asking for standardization. I'm like, what if routines are kind of like you have to follow them? Why do you want routines? And this goes actually back to what Giddens calls ontological security, that if we have patterns of action that we recognize, that we are familiar with, it gives us this ontological security. And if everything is new and you always have to decide what I'm going to do next, that's actually a very uncomfortable situation for most people. If you come into the office in the morning and you know what to expect and what tasks you're going to do and how you're going to do this, this can be actually pretty comforting.
Right. Well, I must insist on a different term, the existential angst.
Yes.
Instead of the ontological insecurity. But this feeling, it only comes into play because it's imposed by the power structure. There would be no insecurity if there would be no repercussions to actions that would be perceived as incorrect.
Oh, I'm not so sure about that.
Is it not so?
That's not what I've seen. I've seen more of what Katarina talks about. Even in circumstances where the employees are not necessarily going to suffer because there's not a routine way to respond, they do find it bothersome. Because I've been in situations, even in the military, where you're in a new environment or it's something you've really not experienced before. And people at the working level, it's experienced a profound sense of unease. And not when they feel like they're going to get blamed for bad results. It does bother them. It seems to me in my experience, which is not universal, that's a big issue for workers.
I was just going to add the case of organizations dealing with complex technology, the one I was studying, for instance, in which there is an important thing of relying on codified knowledge and routines and everything else, what has been done in the past, because since they are dealing with unruly technology, they sometimes feel that they need a place to start. And it's not only an implication of the upper levels, just because, of course, they don't want to produce something that's not secure.
I think the way you have to see it is not that the employees fear repercussions if they do something wrong. It's just if they don't know how to proceed, it's very stressful for them. Or if they don't know what to expect, it's very stressful.
Yes, that's what I've seen.
I think in this, we can go back to the original text, which talks about exactly cognition. And I think one of the things they talk about in cognition is that one of the things that you have to have is the frame of reference, the definition of the situation. And to have the definition of the situation, actors need to simplify what is around them and you need to filter. And the filters they use is exactly based on the programs that exist, the specialization they are, the department they inhabit, the rules that they have to abide. So they see the world from a specific perspective. And that, again, I insist, is enabling because you cannot see everything at once.
Right. Then we're back to routines being a facilitator of any kind of activity because they're comforting.
There's some truth to that. I don't think it's just comforting. I remember Katarina brought up, and is actually in the reading, where they talk about routines facilitate coordination, you know, amongst complex parts of the organization, where you know what the other part is supposed to do, so you can kind of coordinate your activity without having to know in detail exactly what people are doing. You know what, kind of what the other group is supposed to go do. So I think there are many facilitators to organizational efficiency and performance. It's just like you pointed out, Dimitri, there is a darker side that they don't really address in the book that can lead to pathologies or dysfunctional behavior.
I just want to ask this to Katerina. Is any literature on the dark side of routines?
There's a little bit. Sometimes some studies talk about how routines are not necessarily functional, so that they can also be dysfunctional. And in the literature that follows after also 1982, the Nelson and Winter book, they talk a lot about how routines produce inertia and how that is actually very problematic for organizations. So there is that notion.
Just a quick thing, I don't remember this in the reading, and maybe it wasn't in the part that we considered. But if we talk about the dark side, I just would like to know, do they put forward a normative position of that routines are good to begin with, or are they doing a scientific, neutral exploration of this concept?
My impression was that it was the latter, this sort of neutral scientific exploration. Here's what we saw. I didn't see a lot of text where they said it has all these great benefits. I think it was mostly observational, but maybe I wasn't reading closely enough.
What I felt is almost like they're saying that they are necessary, given the way that humans operate and the limits that we have.
I'd like to just consider branching off a little bit into the, I think it's similar to this idea of rationality and boundedness, this idea that, what did you guys think about the statement that they made where routines help eliminates the need or reduces the need to manage uncertainty or to deal with risk? Did that stand out for anybody like it did for me, where I just thought, gee, what if the world doesn't cooperate with you?
Can you elaborate a little bit, Ralph? So what struck you about this?
Right. So what struck me, I'm not sure what page it's on, but there's a statement where they say that they're talking about the skeleton of their basic theory of organizational choice and control, and they specifically say that the organization seeks to avoid uncertainty by following regular procedures and a policy of reacting to feedback rather than forecasting the environment. And what struck me about that was many of the organizations I've been in and have observed, you know, the environment is very chaotic, lots of difficult things going on. And even, I think even in the modern business world, there's a lot of uncertainty in the business planning, that it struck me that that is, I mean, it's not right to call it an overstatement, but unrealistic to say that the routines will shield you from that. That's what struck me about this. I just thought, wow, that can get you into trouble very quickly, I think.
But the routines would be arising from feedback out of the environment, though. So it wouldn't be completely disconnected, I suppose.
And I didn't mean completely disconnected, but I just meant Weick has the concept of, I don't know if it's Weick, but he quotes somebody, talks about the concept of requisite variety. Your organization has to be as complex as the environment which it engages. Otherwise, you're not going to know how to process what's going on in the environment. And it was just my thinking that one of the features of the modern workplace is that there is a lot of dynamic things going on. I'm thinking sort of in terms of chaos theory and leadership and that sort of stuff. And that idea that the organization would seek for a routine to avoid having them to make projections or forecast the environment, I think there's many organizations that that's going to get you into trouble.
I agree with you, Ralph, that there seems to be in these books this assumption that by standardizing and by developing these routines, you can avoid the uncertainty and manage it. Whereas nowadays in organization, we see that's actually counterproductive and it doesn't help you to manage uncertainty. And I think it might be the fact that they wrote this book in the 50s and that was largely, I would guess, I mean, I was not living in the 50s, but I would guess that also a lot of organizations operating in the 50s probably thought this way, or managers thought this way. So there might be actually a shift in the current organizations about how managers think about how to manage uncertainty.
And I think it has to do with the very structure of economy. You know, in those days, there was still the long-term employment, large firm. And today we have a much more, you know, divided economy and more dynamic, if you will. So I think it has to do with the whole setup of how organizations were there.
Just think about the technological development. Now we have internet and emails and being online 24 hours, 7 days a week. That was not the case in the 50s.
Right. So that's what struck me, is not so much that they were wrong back then, it's that the world has progressed and we're in a different place now. It's just less applicable. But I agree with what both of you said. They were just right in the world in which they knew. And it would be very hard for them to predict, you know, today based on what they knew back then. So I think you're right. Maybe I'm a little too harsh, but I actually wasn't criticizing them. It's just saying, well, that doesn't work anymore.
Well, but I mean, at the same time, you still see a lot of standardization actually in organizations. And also, like in general, people trying to establish standards for, I don't know, dealing with waste.
No, even multinationals, as we were saying before, they still try to ensure that some standards are applicable all across the different sites, not least for regulatory purposes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, Katharina, what would be the thing that we should take away from these readings and about routines?
Ooh, that's a big question. I think you've taken away a lot from what I heard in the podcast. I think what you can take away from the readings is this idea of patterns of actions and what role they play in the organization. But I would suggest not to stick too closely to the way they understand routines as stable, like performance programs, pre-planned. That's not how routines actually work, at least from my research. But I think what's valuable about their work is saying that, you know, a lot of work in organizations is based on patterns of actions. And that has certain effects, like helping to reduce complexity and increasing efficiency and stuff like that.
Excellent. Well, thank you. And we were delighted to have you on as our first guest.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I also enjoyed the discussion a lot.
This was fun to have you.
And that concludes episode 4 on the Carnegie Mellon School series with focus on organizational routines. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and like our podcast, please tell your friends and colleagues about us, get in touch on Twitter and Facebook to tell us what you think, and leave a review on iTunes. Even a brief review can help new listeners find us there. Thank you for joining us, and I look forward to seeing you next year as we continue with this podcast and read a text by Mary Parker Follett on Giving Orders.